Well, first I want to thank Aaron Hunt and Steve Staples for coming from Ottawa to talk about this very concerning problem that they've been working hard on and that there's some knowledge about. And it's very fortunate Aaron will be going to New York for the June 15th meetings as this treaty agreement becomes finalized to abolish nuclear weapons. So listening to you, and I guess with all the what I've read and tried to understand about the situation, is I think that what impresses me is that it's so urgent and that we're facing such an emergency, and yet that it's so remote from public awareness. So I wanted to just talk about several things, introduce some facts that in terms of the background, the historical background, as far as I understand it now, about why this has come up now. This is a very big subject, and I'll only touch on a couple of important points, I think. But concerns about the escalation of the nuclear war threats, I think, come at this time from several directions, and that they've led to these international meetings to come to an agreement that would supersede the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that it would centrally call for the abolition of nuclear weapons, not just the non-proliferation. The urgency, I think, comes from heightened tension that started around the Russian-Ukraine situation, in which NATO troops surrounded Russia and continued to be come close to the Russian border. A second factor is missile defense, and I'll talk more about that, but right now it's being installed posing a threat to both North Korea as well as China. And this missile defense heightens the danger of a first strike use of nuclear weapons against North Korea. The third factor is Obama's allocation of over $1 trillion for nuclear weapons upgrade. And a fourth factor is certainly the instability that has been increased under the Trump administration. And just in this past week or two, we've seen major shifts already right away in the Middle East around the situation in Qatar with shifting alliances. So, again, some background about nuclear weapons themselves, which I think, again, is not well known by the public. The nine nuclear states together possess a total of approximately 15,000 nuclear weapons, with the United States and Russia accounting for more than 93%. The Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs are now actually, in comparison to what we have now, rather small-sized nuclear bombs. The Hiroshima bomb killed minimally 250,000 people in Hiroshima and at least 70,000 people in Nagasaki. The explosive force of the Hiroshima bomb was 15 to 16 kilotons of TNT, whereas today's bombs are in the range of 100 kilotons to 550 kilotons, which means that there's 6 to 34 times the Hiroshima force. By comparison, the blast yield of the largest non-nuclear bomb, the MOAB, also called the mother of all bombs, but technically it means massive ordnance air blast, was dropped on Afghanistan. It's well known because Trump made that decision over eating chocolate cake in China. But the force of that bomb is 0.011 kilotons. So, again, that's the largest non-nuclear bomb, and it certainly compares with, you have to compare that with the 550-kiloton bombs that the U.S. and presumably Russia now have. So it is often said that the end of the Cold War around 1990 brought a belief that the nuclear threat was over, and some people feel that that's one reason that people, you know, after that period, and certainly the next generation, know very little about these weapons or about the Cold War. It's daunting and tragic to consider that enough was known at that time so that all nuclear weapons could have been dismantled, and that greenhouse gas emissions also could have been kept at the safe level of 350 parts per million, because that was known too. Instead, militarized economic power and sheer dishonesty have taken the world in the opposite direction, to the brink of human extinction, accelerating greenhouse gas emissions and nuclear proliferation. So lack of information at this time comes from several directions. As early as 1959, an agreement was made by the World Health Organization, to withhold critical statements about the health effects of radiation, unless okayed by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Consequently, it is difficult to obtain information about disasters like Chernobyl or Fukushima, or about the devastating effects on children of U.S. use of depleted uranium in Iraq. NATO does not disclose details about its nuclear weapons, even though member states signed on to a commitment to transparency. And again, NATO now surrounds Russia and China and has expanded into Africa and Latin America. Lack of reporting means that the global public is largely unaware that nuclear weapons remain on high alert, ready to launch within minutes, or that nuclear weapon-armed submarines are roaming the oceans, with each submarine capable of carrying as many as 144 nuclear warheads. There's also the silence in Canada. There's a belief, of course, that Canada has played a more of a salutary role, information and investigation by researchers and politically informed people like Mel Hurtig and Richard Sanders, have exposed that Canada has been involved in missile defense, in the attacks on Iraq, even though that was denied by Canada. Paul McKay has shown that Lester and Andy Bingler have also showed that Lester Pearson was an atomic accomplice, that he certainly provided or allowed Canada to provide the uranium for the U.S. nuclear weapons buildup, and India. And so there's a much more complex role that Canada has played. Richard Sanders of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade has recently revealed that Canada also, the Canadian Pension Plan, invests about $500 million in the nuclear weapons corporations, the 14 major nuclear weapons corporations. So there's also a considerable silence from the media. And I'll go back to the situation in Russia, Ukraine, and just the congruence of what was going on there with, I think, the much heightened anxiety about the possible use of nuclear weapons. So there were a number of meetings also at that time that were really unreported, completely unreported in the press. So in November 2013, that's when Ukraine rejected entry into the EU. In December of that year, that's 2013, that's when the tape that was revealed about Victoria Nuland and the U.S. being involved in the ouster of Yanukovych. So shortly after that, he left Ukraine in February 2014. And around that time, and actually it's in 2013, there was a number of meetings by governments internationally, international organizations, and civil society to address the nuclear weapon situation and to really centrally focus on the need for their abolition based on the catastrophic humanitarian consequences. And it's astonishing that it wasn't up until that time that that was the focus of concern, the human consequences. So there were in Oslo, Norway, in March, there was a participation of 128 nations. There was no reporting about this in the Canadian media. In December 2014, the Vienna meeting led to a humanitarian pledge to abolish nuclear weapons and to the arrangement in the UN to continue those negotiations, which will be finalized this month the beginning of July. So there was no reporting of any of these meetings. In 2015, there was a month-long non-proliferation meeting. That meets every 5 years, so there's no reporting of that. There was also a meeting in Quebec on uranium. There was a meeting in New York called together by Helen Caldicott with many of the major people who are knowledgeable about nuclear weapons. There was also a meeting in Belgium. So none of these meetings were reported about. Currently, what I've seen in the Canadian papers, there was a column by Linda McQuaig and Michael Polanyi, and I think Elizabeth Renzetti. But other than that, there hasn't been any kind of coverage of this. So I wanted to say a little bit about NATO, which has, again, is so closely tied to nuclear weapons use and strategy. Again, in Canada, there's little, a little background provided about NATO and pretty much blanket acceptance of Canada's role in NATO. NATO began in 1949 as a defensive alliance against communism, and in response, the European communist states formed the Warsaw Pact. And then when the Berlin Wall came down, there's a rather famous interchange between George H.W. Bush and Gorbachev. It was a verbal agreement to allow the reunification of West and East Germany based on the condition that NATO would not expand 1 inch to the east. But shortly after, the Clinton administration staked out its stand that NATO should be able to act independently of the United Nations, and in the 1990s, NATO intervened in both Bosnia and in Serbia. So that really set the stage for the Russians, certainly, Yeltsin expresses, knowing that the U.S. would pretty much act unilaterally and do what they wanted to do. Strobe Talbot, who was the Deputy Secretary of State under Clinton, strongly criticized NATO expansion. He said, "Russia's resentment toward the United States and the crisis that erupted in March 2014 with Russia's going into Crimea were not unrelated to the Clinton administration's insistence in the 1990s that NATO be expanded to Russia's borders. It seemed like virtually everyone I know from the world of academe, journalism, and foreign policy think tanks was against enlargement. George Kennan, former ambassador to the Soviet Union, later termed enlargement a strategic blunder of potentially epic proportions." So some of this information is from a really excellent book by Michael Glennon called Double Government. And I highly recommend it. It's very carefully referenced. But he writes about some really quite important things about the U.S. and NATO. He writes that currently, well, he was writing during the Obama administration, but also the background of what had happened since the end of the Cold War, that in the United States, the executive has become the sole organ within the federal government in the field of international relations. The executive determines targeted killing, declares war, nullifies prisoner rights, annuls treaties, expands intelligence and national security measures without requiring congressional approval. The president is able to choose several hundred national security policymakers. Then he writes, success lies in being in the big meeting, reading the key memo, being part of the big decision. The national security policy makers draw a little overt attention, but wield immense unnoticed power. And he writes that this continues regardless of whether the incoming president is Republican or Democratic. He says that these people, this elite within the NSA, defines security as basically military and intelligence rather than politics or diplomacy. This encourages the exaggeration of existing threats and the creation of imaginary ones. This setup is devoid of meaningful constraints. International law affords great deflective possibilities. The UN Charter and the NATO Treaty provide every useful cover, formulating law to legitimize crime. The rules of the UN Charter concerning the use of force can plausibly be marshaled to support virtually any U.S. military action deemed in the national interest. The NATO organization provides credibility, flexibility, and anonymity in equal doses. Its council has no substantive written rules or procedures. It issues no legal guidance or guidelines that might restrict member states. It exercises no standalone authority, since member states have delegated none. No internal rules exist that would render NATO responsible for a violation of international law. The organization's policy is not to reveal which member state participated in a military operation. All of this gives NATO its greatest asset, its capacity to serve as a veil. NATO shields member states from legal and political accountability. There have been no congressional or parliamentary inquiries, no demonstrations outside embassies, and no legal actions threaten member states. So I think one of the things that's important in terms of understanding the very dangerous times in which we live is the lack of constraints, the lack of being able to identify who is ultimately responsible, it's like in the economic sphere, through the free trade agreements, that there are dispute resolution mechanisms that are autonomous, they're above the state, and again. The decisions, for instance, made by the president or within NATO are really function above any international law. And the courts have been ambiguous and ineffective also. In the nuclear area, I think it's an expression of that is the rejection recently by the International Court of Justice of the suit brought by people in the Marshall Islands for all the 64 nuclear weapons testing that has caused so much environmental and human harm in the Marshall Islands, a lot of death. So, in another area that I wanted to talk about was an area of where Canada has a particular interest in terms of its development of the military and its participation and its involvement in NATO and certainly the worst dangers of nuclear weapons, and that's the Arctic. That as the sea ice has melted, it's obviously opened up a corridor for shipping as well as for oil exploration and exploitation. So competition with Russia for the Arctic is a neglected factor too in the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The climate movement has been alert, certainly, to the environmental effects of climate change, but hasn't focused on the military aspect. And the same thing with the military, often neglects the climate, the peace movement. I would say not the military, but the peace movement doesn't connect with the climate. Climate aspects. On June 16th, 2015, Democracy Now! Reported military expansionism into the pristine Arctic wilderness areas, with the U.S. Navy unleashing thousands of sailors, soldiers, airmen, marines, and Coast Guard members, along with several Navy destroyers, hundreds of aircrafts, untold weaponry, and a submarine for the naval exercises. Emily Gilbert, who's a professor of Canadian Studies, or head of the Canadian Studies Department at the University of Toronto, wrote that while the likelihood of an imminent war is slim, the military buildup in the Arctic is ominous as the geopolitical relations in the region become more troubled. Land and undersea territorial claims under the auspices of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea are pitting nations against one another. The U.S. Department of the Navy released a 36-page document in 2009 called the Navy Arctic Roadmap, in which they said that the United States has broad and fundamental national security interests in the Arctic region and is prepared to operate either independently or in conjunction with other states to safeguard these interests. So these interests include missile defense and early warning deployment of sea and air navigation and overflight. Ottawa has conducted its largest ever military exercises, established new bases, and exhibited increasing truculence and saber-rattling toward Russia in that region. U.S. and NATO radar, submarine, and missile deployments in the high north will complete the encirclement of Russia. So, coming back to the Obama's commitment of over $1 trillion for nuclear weapons modernization. This repeats a pattern, and also, you know, it has started again another arms race. Again, the hope and the belief was with the end of the Cold War that this would all be over, but now there's again in both China and in Russia, you know, an investment in modernizing their weapons. There's a historical pattern of U.S. action and USSR, Soviet Union reaction from the past. For example, the first U.S. nuclear chain reaction was in 1942, and it was followed in 1946 by the USSR. The first atom bomb exploded by the U.S. in 1945, and then 4 years later by the USSR. There's so many examples of it. I'll just mention that the multiple warheads on missiles was 1964 in the U.S., and then 9 years later by the USSR. So again, you know, we see this with the current buildup. There's a very important, really crucially important article that I recommend that you all read by Theodore Postol, who is known right now because of his critique of the allegation of chemical warfare used in Syria. He's a professor of physics at MIT and professor emeritus, and he in December 2014, he wrote a really important article in The Nation magazine about missile defense, in which he says that the danger of nuclear war is now much higher than in the Cold War. Again, this was right as in the middle of the Russia-Ukraine crisis when NATO came within, I can't remember how close, 60 miles or something, very close to the Russian border. So Postol noted that the U.S. had a false belief that a nuclear war is winnable, and so that the U.S. recklessly treats nuclear weapons as if they're conventional weapons. So what the missile defense system, and many call it missile offense, it allows a belief that the U.S., NATO can knock out all the opponents, the enemy's nuclear weapons before it strikes back. So this is this has superseded the strategy of mutual deterrence, which was a strategy during the Cold War, with again the belief that a first strike is acceptable, and a nuclear war is winnable. And Postol brings up the fact that because Russia does not have that kind of sophistication, that kind of missile defense system, that they're unable to detect incoming missiles as the U.S. is able to do, and that therefore that in a very tense situation they could plausibly come to not be able to wait in terms of really checking out whether there's indeed a missile missiles coming in. And so it makes the possibility of that kind of misunderstanding deadly, much more possible. But again, the most concerning part is that is this belief that a nuclear war would be winnable. In the Dale Dewar book from Fukushima, there was a co-author, I can't pronounce her name, but it's a book, also an excellent book called From Hiroshima to Fukushima. They state that even a small exchange, a small nuclear exchange between, say, in a localized nuclear war between, say, like India and Pakistan, using 100 Hiroshima-sized weapons, that it would cause a nuclear winter, which would eliminate the world's food supply, essentially, and cause human extinction. So that would be, again, a small-scale nuclear war. And all this, of course, is completely neglected by the military strategists. So again, I think that it's really important to know about this background situation, and I want to just touch on one other aspect of the context of what's going on now, as well as the negotiations. And I think that's I would like to speak a bit about Israel and Iran, because it's very important politically. And much of over the last decades, a lot of the work done by the anti-nuclear weapons groups has really focused on technical aspects as well as legal aspects, and to some extent hasn't as effectively looked at the economic and political aspects. And I think the role of the non-signatories states, which would be Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, is very important. Currently, Israel was I think critically important around two things. One is around keeping the focus on Iran, which is a very political issue in Israel. The focus on Iran has deflected attention to the nations that actually do have nuclear weapons, which of course includes Israel. Israel has had, from the very beginning, a strategy of ambiguity, and has always, never really, in fact, nobody ever actually, I shouldn't say nobody, but the decision makers don't adequately look at Israel's, or including Israel's threat. Like when they talk about a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, they're often really looking at Iran, but not at Israel. So, but the reason that I want to talk about it now is because in the 2015 meetings in New York, the UN, the NPT review meetings that go on for a month, there was a lot of urgent concern about taking nuclear weapons on high alert status because of the tense political situation, and that whole thing became deflected by focusing on Iran and the Iran weapons, and you know, Israel really was very key in that. So even though Israel hadn't even signed the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, it played a critical political role in deflecting attention to Iran and not focusing on what was going on with NATO and the U.S. and the encirclement of Russia and China and NATO expansion. So just in terms of of Iran as a nuclear threat, I'll just again mention that at that time, even Israel's Mossad, which is equivalent to the CIA, maintained that Iran did not have a nuclear program. And there were other international experts who maintained that also, like Richard Falk is one. Seymour Hersh had much earlier written about Israel's nuclear weapons. And again, what these people write about is that Iran was politically was used in a politically opportunistic way by politicians in Israel, like to foment fear and to strengthen their own positions politically. But another aspect I think that's really important to know about Israel is their tie with, well, they're a major weapons supplier and nuclear weapons, but they're a major partner now. They have an agreement with India, again a non-signatory of the NPT. There was a really eye-opener article in Reform Judaism magazine called "Strategic Bedfellows" that was very much in favor of this alliance I'll read a few things from that article. One of the points they say is that both Israel and India have contended with threats to national security from neighboring countries. For India, the threats come from China and Pakistan, and for Israel, it's from the Arab states. So they both see themselves as democracies in a sea of countries that have large Muslim majorities and who are hostile to their countries. They say that both nations, despite these dangers, have never wavered in their commitment to democracy, and that both are committed to a knowledge-based society emphasizing learning, science, and technological advancement. So the really big concern is that they have an agreement really they have an alliance which supposedly in the interest of creating a formidable force for stability in a region threatened by radical fundamentalism and tyrannical theocracy. India has offered Israel a naval base in the Indian Ocean. They say their worry is an Islamic nuclear bomb, that they wouldn't launch a first strike unless they were attacked, even by a chemical or biological warfare. So in effect, they're saying that they would, launch a first strike even against a non-nuclear attack. So again, this is a huge area of potential conflagration with both these nuclear armed countries. So I guess I'll just finish by saying that by emphasizing how very dangerous and concerning the military and economic situation is, worldwide, that this huge, expansion and tolerance of nuclear weapons comes at a time, as I'm sure many of you know, of such an increase in horrific economic inequity in the world, with increasing militarization and the militarization of police, militarization of borders, that in 1990 there were something like, I can't remember, like 7 walled borders, and now there's, I think it was more than that, maybe 9, I can't remember, but now there's, I believe, 70 walled borders, and these are heavily militarized, that the situation of refugees is, you know, in the world is really horrific, that that there's more, I guess, now there's something like 64 million refugees and internally displaced people. 35,000 people a day are displaced because of military conflicts. And there was a very, very tiny article, one of those inserts in the Toronto Star, you know, that a couple of weeks ago, that 11 million people were at threat of starvation in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, Nigeria. The actual number has gone up to, the latest figures I saw were 20 million people threatened. The world, the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization is broke, and the UN, the UNHCR, High Commissioner for Refugees, and the head of the UN really talk about this being the worst, you know, possibly the worst humanitarian disaster historically. And there's, again, hardly the money coming in. They need about $4 billion immediately. I think $2 billion or less has been collected. It's really, I have the figures which are really quite shocking about how little has been collected. I think Canada is about a third in terms of donations. The U.S. has provided the most, I think, something like $600 million. Canada has donated about $181 million. If you look at the FAO website, you can find the figures. I noticed that Saudi Arabia, Israel had not, weren't even on the list. But again, you know, this is a hugely dire situation, and you wouldn't really, you know, you wouldn't know it from what's being reported in the major media. Oh, here I have some of the figures. Yeah. So Canada's donated $181 million, Switzerland $51 million, China $35 million. Interestingly, as I said, Saudi Arabia hasn't donated any. Malawi donated $3 million, Niger $6 million. So, you know, it's quite interesting which countries, even the very, very poor, and also it's the poorest countries too that are really taking in all the refugees. There was a very good Amnesty report about that recently, about the you know, the neglect by the wealthiest countries and their reluctance to open up their borders, which should be a key issue for people, you know, the peace movement, anti-nuclear movements, as well as climate movement, you know, much concerned about migration and the real need to open up borders given the conditions of the world. So I'll just stop here. And again, I think, you know, I would hope that there would be much more widespread knowledge and protest against this intolerable situation. There is a women's march in New York at the beginning of these negotiations to ban the bomb. That would be on June 17th. And so I think we all have to get to work and work very persistently, as Stephen Sables and Aaron Hunt have done. So anyway, thank you very much for attending this and paying attention to this huge issue.